It's time now for Sunday Fireside as we feature talks of general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and other popular speakers. On today's program, we feature two outstanding talks, the first by Brother Travis Tuttle, our second speaker, Elder Jack N. Girard of the 70. Our first speaker, Brother Travis Tuttle, was a missionary serving in Samara, Russia, when he and his companion were kidnapped. There was a movie done on the kidnapping called The Saratova Approach. This talk was delivered at the Ephraim LDS Institute of Religion back in March of 2015. Our first speaker, Brother Travis Tuttle.
Before we go much farther on this, though, I want to start off with a scripture, and this is actually found in Mosiah chapter 2. I love Mosiah, I love King Benjamin, and I love King Benjamin because he was such a great leader. I look at the world that we live in now, and I think one of the things that we desperately yearn for is true leaders. I think that we have so many people that would love to have their names on the front page of the newspaper and say what great people they are and what great leaders they are, yet it's very seldom do they want to do any of the work that it takes and requires to be a great leader. King Benjamin was just the opposite, though. He would never ask anybody to do anything that he himself was not willing to do. And he starts off he's addressing the people. And in chapter 2, verse 15, he says, "Yet, my brethren, I have not done these things that I might boast, neither do I tell these things, thereby I might accuse you. But I tell you these things that you may know that I can answer a clear conscience before God this day. Behold, I say unto you, because I said unto you that I have spent my days in your service, I do not desire to boast, for I have only been in the service of God. And behold, I tell you these things that you may learn wisdom, that you may learn that when you are in the service of your fellow beings, you are only in the service of your God." And so I want everyone to understand that in no way is it my intention to brag about myself or to brag about Andrew or anything that took place for us when we were serving so long, what feels like so long ago. We were doing what so many people before us have done and what several people have just been announced as getting ready to go do. And by the way, whoever that individual is that's going to the Washington mission, I've had the opportunity to speak in that mission as well and to be there. Superb mission. You're going to have a great mission president wherever you are, and so you have a lot to look forward to. But I just want to make it clear that it's not our intention to boast about anything that took place with us, and Andrew and I have a great relationship, but there was a period of time that we actually had fallen out of touch with each other, and there wasn't really a specific reason other than probably the means of communication that we have today were not the same as they were 16 or so years ago when we got home. There was no Facebook, there was no Instagram or anything like that to stay in touch with each other, and cell phones were just starting to become somewhat affordable. Andrew was living in Oregon. I was in Arizona. We both were kind of getting on with life. And a few years ago, I actually got a call from Andrew out of the blue. And he said, "Hey, man, how you doing? Good. How are you? Good." And we chatted for a minute. And he said, "I got a call from this guy that wants to make a movie about us." And I said, "Well, about what?" And he said, "Well, about the kidnapping." And I said, "Man, that was like 13 or 14 years ago. Nobody cares. Like, I don't even care. And it happened to me." And I said, "Well, who is this guy?" And he said, "Well, his name's Garrett Batty." Well, I happened to be sitting in front of a computer, so I did what anybody would do, and I typed in Garrett Batty. And nothing came up. I was like, "Well, that's kind of weird." So I flipped over to IMDb, and I typed in Garrett Batty. And what do you know? He actually had made a movie. And I'm like, "Oh, that's good. We're headed in the right direction. Guy wants to make a movie. He's made a movie. Okay." And he had made a movie called Scout Camp. And the thing about Scout Camp was it had received half of a star. And so I said, "Andrew, this guy's made a movie called Scout Camp that received half of a star. I think we should say no. And when you've got George Lucas on the phone, you let me know and I'll say yes. But for today, I'm going to say it's been great to talk to you. No." So then he calls back a couple days and he's like, "Hey, this guy really wants to talk to us. He said he wants to set up a conference call and kind of pitch his idea." I'm like, "Yeah, I know what his idea is. It's going to be three dudes in a backyard with iPhones running around and be like, and action. Hey, could you get the kid out of the background, please? We're trying to make a movie." And I said, I don't want the most personal thing that's ever happened to be like this big spectacle and a really, really cheesy, quote unquote, Mormon film. There's plenty of those out there already. We don't need to make another one. And Andrew said, well, let's just listen to him and see what he has to say. A conference call is free, and it'll get us both out of work for a half an hour. And he was right. So we set up a call, and we're listening to what Garrett has to say, and I realize that this is a really bad idea. He's got great intentions, bad idea. And he said, what I'd really like to do is I'd like to get the three of us together, and I really want to hear the story beginning to end. And this is in August, so nobody wants to go to Arizona in August because it's like 200 degrees. Garrett lives in Salt Lake. Andrew's in Idaho, as I said, so we all decided to go to Idaho. And we meet up in Idaho, and we tell the story, and Garrett is a giddy three-year-old at Christmas time, so excited. He thinks he's got the greatest thing ever, and he's like, oh, this will be the best movie ever. You guys are going to love it. I got to go make a movie. And Andrew and I went golfing. That was after 2 days of, like, not seeing the sun because Garrett had a million and one questions. And so time kind of goes by and nothing really happens, and Garrett's having trouble raising funds. And he finally gets some money together, and it wasn't nearly as much as we thought it needed to be to make a good quality movie. You know, you hear, like, the movie cost, like, $50 million to make it, and the first weekend it made $100 million. So we didn't think they needed $50 million, but we certainly thought they needed some million. And they had like two nickels and a guy with an iPhone. And he donated the iPhone. He's like, here's my iPhone, you can use it for free. And we were blown away by the team that Garrett was able to put together and the results that were able to come from it. A common question is, do I still work? And yes, I still work because we didn't make any money off of it, but it sure was a great experience, and it was a lot of fun to meet a lot of really cool people and to go through this and to see a lot of testimony strengthen and a lot of conversions take place. But really, if you look back at my life and what took place, the story, the kidnapping, the meeting with Garrett, the phone call from Andrew, none of that should have ever taken place. Because when I was maybe just a tad bit younger than most of you, my desire to go serve a mission was non-existent. 16, 17, didn't understand why anybody would willingly want to leave home for a year and a half or 2 years to go to a foreign place. And I consider a foreign place pretty much any place outside of what you are accustomed to. And so if you're accustomed to, we'll just say Salt Lake City, since some of you are from there. Going to Canada, well, Canada's too far. Let's just take going to Texas. That's going to be very foreign and different. And I couldn't understand why anybody would ever sign up for anything like that. That just didn't make sense. And education is highly emphasized in my family growing up. And my mom was a teacher. My grandma was a school teacher. And so education was an emphasis. I was lining myself up with college scholarships, both academically and in sports. I had it all taken care of. I was going to be able to go to 4 years for free. Why would I want to jeopardize any of that for a mission? When the stories that I was hearing for people were getting chased by people, having people slam the door on your face, having people yell at you, throw things at you, that did not sound like fun. And the one thing that you have to understand is I don't sit still very well, and I like to go, and I like to do things, and I like to have fun. And I didn't see how I was going to be able to accomplish any of those things going on a mission. And the other thing that was really hard for me to understand was, how in the world was I going to be able to put sports down, mainly a tennis racket, down for 2 years and go do this other stuff? I wouldn't even have really considered myself to be much of a religious person. And so now I'm going to put down the one thing that I truly love, tennis racket, go talk to people about something that is kind of foreign and awkward to me. And I'm going to have to go to a foreign place and do that. So it was scary, more than anything. And when I was about 17, my dad asked me if I was going to go serve and what my thoughts on it were. Now, you have to understand, my dad didn't have the opportunity to serve when my mom and dad got married young. And I told him I didn't think it was for me. I didn't think it was something that would benefit me. And he said, which I was really surprised, he said he understood. And he said that he thought the best thing that I should do was to really think about it. And he wanted me to look big picture. He wanted me to think beyond 4 years of school. He wanted me to think beyond playing sports, beyond getting an education. He wanted me to think life. And he wanted me to think about laying a foundation for what was going to be ahead of me. And he tried to explain to me, it was really hard at the time, that your athletic abilities will decrease over life, but you're still going to have to keep going. And he tried to point out to me that although I was good, I was not great. And although school would probably be free, I was still going to have to get a job someday. At the same time, my grandparents were serving a mission in Singapore, getting great letters back from them. They were having a lot of fun. They were talking about missionaries and how good they were doing and the transformations that were taking place for them. And at the same time, our Stake Young Men's president, or excuse me, Stake Young Men's missionary prep teacher was amazing. His name was Jim Goodwin. And Jim, he cared about the young men and young women probably more than most of the parents did. And by profession, he was a private investigator. Mission prep class for us at the time was at 6 a.m. on Sunday. And so the only problem with 6 a.m., as most of you probably know, is that's only just a couple hours before you actually go to bed. So getting up and going somewhere at 6 a.m. when you're 17, that's not a very good idea. But the great thing about Brother Goodwin was he cared about us so much that if we missed a week, he would call and he would just, "Hey, I missed you. Is everything okay?" And then if you missed again, he would be so kind as to call your parents and say, "Hey, I haven't seen him for a couple weeks. Is everything going okay?" And then if you missed the third week, he would actually just show up at your house and he would help you go. And he did not care about appearance. You could go in basketball shorts and a t-shirt. If swim trunks were your thing and flip-flops, he didn't care. He just wanted you there. And so to avoid humiliation of him showing up and taking you, we all went. So I was able to think big picture, and I was able to look outside myself, and I kind of had this, kind of put an agreement in place with God. And I don't really think it works like this, but I basically said, "Listen, I'll go serve. I'll be the hardest working missionary you've ever seen. I might not be the best, but I'll be the hardest working. I'll follow the rules. I'll do what I'm asked. But a couple things. One, you've got to get me out of the U.S. because I thought that was really important. So I put that down, leave America. And then I said, I've got to have fun. And it's got to be a lot of fun. I don't necessarily have to play tennis every day, but we're going to have fun. So I put that on there and I said, here you go. Here's my wish list. Come back and let me know where I'm going. And I couldn't have been more excited when the call came to be going to Russia Samara. Now, we're going back a few years, and this wasn't jump on your iPhone and see where Russia Samara is. This was like, pull out the encyclopedia, let's see if we can find it. And we couldn't find it because we didn't have an updated version, and we had no idea. All we knew was that we were going to Russia. We knew where Moscow was, and that's where it stopped. Mom was super stressed out and crying. She was hoping for Moscow, Idaho. I was super excited, and if I could have left that afternoon, it probably wouldn't have been soon enough. So I got the call to Russia, and that's where it was. And when I showed up on the first day of work, I couldn't have been more excited. Russia and I were meant for each other. I love the people tremendously. I love everything that they are, and they're who they are, their commitment to life, and the desire to try to create a better life. It's a dirty place. It's a backwards place. It's an interesting place, and I loved it, and I still do with all my heart. I got sent down to, I was in a couple of areas before I ended up in Saratov, and I was there for 11 months. Now, for anybody that served or you've had other people serve, staying in one area for 11 months is quite an extended period of time. But I loved it. We were kind of in the middle of nowhere, not quite like Snow College middle of nowhere, but there wasn't really a lot going on. And it was perfect because there wasn't a lot of distractions. Now, we didn't have cars, we didn't have bikes, everything was by foot, and I couldn't have been more excited to be there. Andrew and I were assigned to serve together, and we knew that we were only going to be together for a month. I was finally getting transferred and going to another city. Andrew was coming in to take over. The ironic part about our month together was during a portion of this, he was actually leaving to go to get his visa renewed. After you'd been in Russia for a year, you had to actually leave the country. So the missionaries would go to Finland just long enough to go get a slice of pizza from Pizza Hut and get your passport stamped and come back. And it took a week. It was actually a miserable trip. But at the same time, we all looked forward to it because we got to have some pizza. It's the small things. We only had about a week or so left, and Andrew and I were actually on splits. He was going to be presenting in Zone Conference, and one of the traditions we had in our little area with the missionaries was to have dinner together on Sunday after church. We had a member that was in the ward, and his name was Carl. Carl was missing both of his legs, horrible eyesight, bad hearing. He had actually escaped from Nazi Germany, lost his legs due to gangrene, going through freezing cold water. And so we would take Carl home, and I pushed open the door of this. Where we met was this old two-story communist building. Ironic that the Mormons would be meeting in the communist building, but that was the only place we could find. And we opened up the door, and I walk out the door, and no sooner do I open it that there's someone standing behind it. And he startled me that he was so close. And I said, can I help you? And he said, yeah, I'm looking for the Mormons. Now, a minute ago I said I wasn't going to brag, but I was wrong. I'm going to. I know that there's been a lot of missionaries that have gone, and there's been some really effective ones. But Andrew and I were maybe, quite possibly, the very best there ever was. As Andrew was leaving to go back to the apartment to finish preparing, he had actually passed this young man walking up to the building. And the guy had stopped him and he said, hey, I'm looking for the Mormons. And Andrew said, oh, perfect. They're right up there at that building. There's a bunch of them in there. They can help you. And he kept on going. And he comes to me next and he said, well, I'm looking for the Mormons. I've got a friend on the other side of town that is a member, and I just want to know more about your church. And I said, oh, perfect. There's a bunch of them up on the second floor. They look just like us. They've got the name tag and everything. Stop one of them, and they'll gladly help you. And he said, actually, I'm kind of nervous. I don't really want to go talk to anybody. And I said, well, with missionaries, this is what we do. Can we come over and see you on, say, Wednesday? And he said, that'd be fine. And so we get down his information, and no sooner do we write down his name and his address, I look up and he's gone. He's walking down the path to get back on the train. And I turned to the other missionary that was with me and I said, that was really weird. And he agreed with me. Same time, we were extremely excited because a male had approached us, wanted to talk about the gospel and church, and this never happens. And wait, come to think of it, in over a year of being in Russia, no one's ever approached me and wanted to talk about God. They wanted to beat me up or take me to jail or kick me out of the country, but they didn't want to talk about God, so this is fantastic. That night I tell Andrew, hey, I saw this guy, set up this discussion. He said, oh yeah, kind of this crazy guy, and he described him like, yeah, that's the one. He's like, oh, I saw him. But I just sent him your way because I'm super effective and just had to keep going on down the path. Wednesday rolls around and it's time for us to get ready to go. And as we're getting ready to leave, we realize that we don't have an extra Book of Mormon that we're going to be able to give him. Now, I realize the discussions have changed drastically since I was a missionary, and you go from Preach My Gospel Now, which is fantastic. But how are we going to go and talk to this young man and say, hey, we want you to read this book that we're not going to give you. And then after you read this book that we're not going to give you, we want you to pray about it. And then after you don't read this book that you don't have and you pray about it, we're going to come back and we're going to follow up. And we're going to ask how everything went. And then we're going to talk to you about baptism. Does that sound like a good idea? And Andrew's point was valid that this is going to be extremely ineffective. Why are we doing this? Well, fortunately for us, I was the senior companion. And I said, hey, I'm the senior companion. We're going to go. We're going to do this. And so we made the journey. We started off in the first apartment that has kind of the circle around it, and then we made our way down about a mile, a little over a mile in distance from each other. Now, keep in mind, this is in March. So right around this time of year, the days are still short. It was still plenty cold outside. And when we got to the apartment complex, we had a really tough time even finding the right stairwell that we were supposed to be going into. Most missionaries carried flashlights with us, but since Andrew and I were so effective, we didn't have one. We finally find the right stairwell to go to, but one of the common things that the teenagers would do is they would bust out the lights on the floor. So most of the time, the stairwells were completely dark. That goes back to having a flashlight, and then you can see where you're going, but seeing how we were so effective, we didn't carry one with us. When we got to the third floor, we weren't sure which apartment it was. Now, the Russian housing system is very different than what we have here. They'll have a door, and then behind that door, there's going to be at least two more. Sometimes there's as many as eight more doors. So it was always fun when you'd ring a doorbell and, someone would come open the door, and then there would be like three or four heads that would pop out of the doors. Hey, we're missionaries from the church of, and then all the doors would slam. Okay, well, we'll come back in a week and we'll try this again. And we find the right, doorbell, and there was two of them right on top of each other, and so we guessed and we ring the doorbell. And no sooner do we ring the doorbell, but the same young man that we had saw a couple days ago opens the door. Only this time when he opens the door, he's completely dressed in his street clothes, which is definitely not a Russian custom. They take off the hat, the beanies, the shoes. They don't have carpet indoors. It's all pretty much linoleum. And being outside is always really dirty, so they take all of that off. And I said, hey, did you remember that we were coming by? And he said, yes. Well, do you think it would be okay if we came in and talked to you? Sure, I just got home, so I apologize. And we walk into his apartment, and we come into the front door, and it's really weird. He's still got his street clothes on. The apartment's completely dark except this light in the hallway. He said he just got home, but he didn't pass us coming in. There was only one entrance into his stairwell. There's a TV on in the other room that's on really loud, and none of this is really making any sense. So what makes the most sense is for us to start taking off our winter clothes, which is the jacket, the boots, the gloves, the hat, the scarf, and go teach this guy. And I take all of that off, and I grab my backpack, and I start walking into this dark room where the TV is, and no sooner do I take half a step in there, I hear Andrew start screaming behind me. And as I'm turning around to see what's going on, this young man that has invited us over comes up behind me and he starts hitting me in the head with basically a baseball bat. These are the actual bats that they used to beat us with. Someone had come out of the other room and had started hitting Andrew in the head as well. So the combination of being hit and turning around to see what's going on with Andrew, I fell down. Andrew had fallen down. We had reached for the door a couple of times to get us out, and they would hit us in the hands, hit us in the head. We went around for a minute in this little fight. It really wasn't much of a fight. It was more of them beating on us. And I was getting ready to stand up and go for the door again, and I hear the distinct sound of a gun being cocked. And I go back on all fours, and I look up, and all I can see is this guy in all black, with a ski mask on, with holes cut out for the eyes and the mouth, with a gun pointed at me, and he said, be quiet and don't move. He used a few other words, but we'll just go with be quiet and don't move. They immediately picked us up. They took us into the kitchen, and they put his face down on the ground. When we walked into the kitchen, I noticed that the stove was on, and there's 6-inch flames shooting off the stove because all they use is gas cookers. Throw us on the ground, they put our hands behind the back, they put handcuffs on, they go in the room and they start talking to each other. And Andrew and I are talking to each other back and forth, and Andrew says, we're going to die, we're going to jump out the window. If we don't jump, they're going to kill us. And I told Andrew that was a very bad idea because we have handcuffs on and we're on the third floor, and if we jump out, we're still going to die. And I would rather be shot than jump out the window and go through that pain, maybe don't die. They didn't like us talking very much, so they came in and they put tape over our eyes and mouth. And when they put the tape over my mouth, they covered up about 3/4 of my nose. We were probably in the kitchen for about a half an hour, and they came and they got me first. And they stood me up, and they put my jacket back over the top of me, zipped it up. They took a beanie, and they pulled it down over my face, and they took me outside. And as soon as we walked outside, or out of the apartment, someone's coming off the elevator, and I can hear them, and the only thing I can think of is, hey, you've got to be able to see the guy with the beanie pulled down over his face. Can you help him out a little bit? And Sergey, that was with me, took me and slammed me up against this concrete wall and bounced my head off the wall and said, act drunk. Now, I've never been drunk, but I had a pretty good idea of how to do it. They took me down, and they put me in the back of a car. And this was not the exact car, but very similar to the Lada that everybody drove. They left me in the back of the car for a minute, and they brought Andrew down, and they put him on top of me. And when they brought Andrew down, his elbow ended up in my esophagus. I've got my back arched so that I can keep all the weight off of my hands because they hurt so bad from the handcuffs, and we start driving away. And I realized pretty quick that one of two things is going to happen. If we continue on as is, I'll suffocate and I'm going to die. But if I say anything, I might tick them off and they might shoot me. So I decided to roll the dice and go for the ladder. And I licked the bottom of the tape and I just said, I can't breathe. And they pulled the car over and they kind of moved us around and I ended up on the floorboards of the car. And we started driving down the road. I'd been in this area for 11 months and I knew exactly where we were, even blindfolded. And as we were driving, I said to myself, if we turn left, we'll be fine. If we turn right, we're going to die. And we turned right. And we drove for about 40 minutes, and we came to a second apartment. And so this is kind of the map of where they took us. We started out at the arrow, and we ended up at the circle. And so you can see it's a very remote area where they took us. And they took us into the back to another apartment. They put us down on the ground. They took one handcuff off, and they put it behind a pipe that's coming off the radiator that's heating the house. So now I can go up, and they put the handcuff back on, so I can go up and down, but I can't go out. And they sit us back down, and they're asking me all sorts of questions. And they're asking specific names, addresses, phone numbers. And I didn't have that information. I didn't know it. I usually carried around a list with me for this night. I didn't have it with me. They're getting very frustrated with me in particular. And they came over to me after a few minutes, and they put about a half hour of questions, and they put over the top of me what turned out to be a clear plastic bag. Thicker than like a white trash bag, not as thick as like a blue tarp. And Sergey takes a few steps back, and he cocks his gun. And of course, I can't see him because I got tape over my eyes. But all I can envision is this very large man with his gun pointed at me, and this is how I was going to go out. And it was a very sad moment to think that my mom and my dad were going to get a phone call. We're sorry he didn't make it. And I felt bad for him in that moment, that they were going to be receiving that. And he cocked the gun, and he waited a few seconds, and he dry-fired the gun, and then they took a Polaroid picture. Yeah, that was my Polaroid picture. Probably not the best. And they took the plastic from me, and they went over to Andrew, and they did the same thing. Sergey left, and he went and made a ransom note. He came back and read it to us, and he wanted us to sign it. So if you've never seen a kidnapping ransom note in Russian, there you go. That's the English version, and basically it says, don't alert the media, don't tell the police, don't try to find him, or we're going to kill him. And that was a tough moment. We were sure that we were done. But they wanted us to sign the ransom notes. And so Andrew signed his. Please help, Mom and Dad. They kicked it over to me, and I signed mine, and I wrote in Russian. I said, give these guys what they want. Don't argue. They took the notes, and they left. And I remember waking up the next morning, and I couldn't believe what had taken place. I couldn't believe that we were there. I had asked for fun, and this was way more fun than I had signed up for. We eventually got a little bit more brave, and we got up off the bed, and or off the ground. We asked if we could sit on the bed, and so we can kind of see underneath the tape a little bit. And we've got in the room the bed that we're sitting on. There's a little half-high dresser that's in there. There's an ironing board, and there's a radio. And so that's where we sat for the next week. And I look back on what took place, and there was a couple of huge blessings in that moment. One, we had a radio that was playing classic rock music coming out of Moscow, and we're both huge fans of classic rock. And so for us in that moment, it was this huge blessing. When we didn't have anything to say to each other or talk about, we had the Doors, we had the Beatles, we had the Who to keep us company for a few minutes. And I credit Andrew with a lot of the things that took place, but we kept ourselves extremely active and extremely busy. We would play word games. Who can think of the word, most words that end in ED? And you'd go back and forth, looked, booked, hiked, jumped, and then you run out of words and there's a winner. And there was no trophies or no prize money, but in that moment it felt great to be able to beat him. And that's just what happens when you put the two most competitive people in the world in a room, handcuffed to each other, they come up with stuff like that. But the one thing that I noticed was that for the first time in my life, I was taking time to listen, to pay attention to the things that were going on around me. And I distinctly remember that when a Beatles song came on, was this the last time that I would hear him? Was I ever going to hear Strawberry Fields again? Strawberry Fields isn't even my favorite song. But it was so real in that moment. It was like John and Paul, Ringo were in there with me. I could feel it. I could hear it. And it was this incredible moment. One of the things that I'll challenge you with today is to take time out of life for the moments. Take time to feel the music, to hear what it's really saying. We're so busy, we run from thing to thing that we never have time to actually listen. On Friday morning, the radio said that two American missionaries had been kidnapped. And we were pretty scared because we knew that was us. And that day at lunch, Andrew actually, when they would come in, they would give us our meal for the day. They would undo the handcuffs and we could eat. And he made it look like the handcuffs went back on, but they actually didn't. And after that moment, when we realized we were free, we started coming up with all of these different ideas of how we could escape. And we came up with a lot of good ones. I'll be honest with you. There were some really good ones. But we were smart enough in the moment that we could talk about, here's what you're going to do, here's what I'm going to do, here's what they're going to do. And all of our stories kept ending the same way, in that we were going to get shot. And we finally came up with an idea that Andrew was going to go stand on the edge of the bed, and I was going to call Nikolai in. And when Nikolai came in, my job was to jump up, go grab the iron, and I was supposed to hit Nikolai in the head with the iron while Andrew threw a sheet over the top of him. And we're ready to execute. Part of our plan calls for shooting Nikolai if we need to. And we had decided in the moment that it's shoot to kill. So Andrew stands up on the corner of the bed, and he's ready to go. And I tell him, when you give me the sign, I will call him in. And he stands up there, and he doesn't say anything. And he stands up there, and he said, I don't know if I can do this. And I said, sit down, let's talk about this some more. All my years of sports, all my years of doing stuff, I understand what an adrenaline rush feels like. And this was nothing that I had ever experienced before. We were so amped up in the moment and so overrun with emotions that when we sat down and we talked about it and we prayed about it and came up with all these different ideas, the one idea that made the most sense, let me take that back. The one idea that we knew we had to do that made the least amount of sense was to put the handcuffs back on. And in the moment, we had finally become concerned with everything else around us and not about us. We were concerned that when Sergei came back and saw Nikolai down and probably dead, what was he going to do? Was he going to come after us? Was he going to go after other missionaries? Was he going to go after members? Was he going to go after civilians of the area? We didn't want anybody else to have to go through what we were going through. And I can tell you, of all the hard things that I've done in my 37 years, that was the hardest. Because I was convinced that by putting those back on, I would not walk out the front door alive. But I knew, we knew, that it's what had to be done. And after we put them on, it was the greatest feeling. It was like all the stress, the pressure of the moment, of the world, was gone. We had zero confidence we would walk out of there alive, but we knew that it was the right thing to do. Sunday morning, Sergei came into the room and he said, "We're setting you free." We, of course, did not believe him. They loaded us into the back of the car and they got us ready to go. And I apologize. We've gone a little bit over time, so if anybody needs to leave for class, I completely understand. I'm not offended. But going back just a little bit, they had us sign another ransom note. And I was on top. I wrote mine on top, and it said, "To my mom and dad, do not be sad if we die. God bless my sisters." And then Andrew wrote below, "This is Andrew, mom and dad. I love you so much. Please don't be upset if we die. We've decided to do it for the benefit of the other missionaries and for the work." And we were so overcome and so in the moment that we couldn't undo the work that had been done before us. Now, keep in mind, this is 1998. Russia had only been officially opened in 1993 or 4. So we've only got 4 or 5 years of missionaries coming before us and doing work. It would have been so incredibly selfish of us to undo what they had done. And we just couldn't bring ourselves to do it. And so when Sergei came in and said that he was going to set us free, we didn't believe him. There's no way. It's not the logical thing to do. If they kill us and get rid of us, they walk away free. And they took us out in the middle of a field, and they pushed us out of a car, and they drove away. And they said that we couldn't take the tape off for 2 minutes. So, of course, being excellent hostages that we were, we waited our 2 minutes. And then we took the tape off. And Andrew jumped up, and he starts running through this field. And I'm like, "Where are you going?" He's like, "I'm out of here. These guys are coming back. Good luck." I'm like, "Listen, I realize we've only known each other for a few weeks, but I feel like we've come a long way in our relationship. And now you're going to leave me? Just like this, now?" And he's like, "Good luck." Well, fortunately, there was like 3 feet of new snow on the ground, and he hasn't eaten for a week, so he ran like 50 feet, and he's like, "I'm tired. I'm just going to lay back down right here." And I can tell you that it was a top 10 moment for me, over the top excited. I've never been so excited to just be alive, to be in the moment, and it was truly exciting. We finally hitched a ride back into town, and we went to one of the branches. Church was just getting over. It took us a long time, we eventually found the missionaries, and they had all been pulled off the street, and they were put into a hotel. And another top 10 moment was walking into that hotel and seeing all of those missionaries down this huge hallway, and we were so excited to see each other. And it was as if Andrew and I had just scored the winning touchdown of the Super Bowl, and there was this huge dog pile. And that lasted just a few seconds, and they came and pulled both of us off and took us away and made us identify ourselves. Within a few days, we were on a plane, and we were headed to Germany. We were there with an area authority, and he took us into this really nice conference room, and so, full disclosure, he takes us into this conference room, and there's a phone that's on this desk. Well, we got to talk to our parents for about 30 seconds after it happened, and the only thing that we want to do is talk to our parents. So the area authority brings us in, and he's like, "So you have two options. You can stay, and we'll get you reassigned, or you can say, 'I want to go home,' and we give you an honorable release, and we send you on a plane, you go home." And he said, I've got to go. And he left. And we talked to each other for literally like 2 minutes, maybe less. And we're like, yeah, we're staying. Why would we go home? And to us in the moment, we really didn't understand why he gave us the option to go home. It didn't make sense. We still had 6 months left. What are we going home to? Why are we leaving early? What are we going to accomplish? Yeah, so, you know, we had a rough week. But lots of people have rough weeks. And so we walked out of the conference room and we went to the secretary and we were like, well, hey, can you let him know that we decided we're going to stay? And I'm dead serious. She looked at me like I had three heads. And she's like, you want to do what? And I'm like, yeah, we want to stay. He said we could stay if we wanted to. We want to stay. And she's like, do you want to go talk about it somewhere? Do you need some more time? No, we're good. Really, what we want to do is we want to go back in there and use the phone and call our parents. But we're good. And she's like, well, I'll give you some time to... No, for real, we're good. We want to stay. And she said, okay, we'll tell them. We stayed in Germany for a month, and then we were both reassigned. We went to England. I went to the London, England South Mission, and he went to not the London, England South Mission. Another mission in England that I can't remember which one it is, but I'm sure it's a good one as well. We went back to Russia twice, once for further questioning, once for the trial. It was extremely difficult to go back and forth as a missionary. When we would go to Russia, we weren't allowed to do anything. And that was hard for us. We got in trouble both trips for going and doing things we weren't supposed to. Another story in itself. And I will tell you that I almost feel selfish for having such an incredibly wonderful mission. I had experiences that most people don't ever get to have in their life. I got to see so many different parts of the world. I got to talk to so many great people. And the common question that is posed to us is, how in the world can you guys talk about this? How can you be so open about it? And I think there's a couple reasons, a couple answers to that. One, we're extremely blessed. We're extremely fortunate for the situation that we're in. But the other reason was we refused to give up. The situation was pretty bad. And truth be told, we shouldn't have walked away alive. But we did. So now what are we going to do with this opportunity? So at the age of 20, I had just earned a PhD in life. Yeah, I needed some guy to hit me in the head with a baseball bat and hold a gun to my head for a week. But I had received it. And the one thing that I realized was I just went through one of the hardest things I'm ever going to have to deal with in my entire life. If I can go through that, what can't I accomplish? Can I take care of 5 kids and be the sole moneymaker? I guess so. Let's go do it. Can I go to college and work full time? I guess so. Let's go do it. And I've realized throughout my life, as I've done all of these hard things, that at the end of the day, I'm still standing. And that thing that was so hard that wasn't going to be able to be accomplished, I've been able to accomplish all of them. And I'm still standing. Now, it hasn't come with a little few bumps in the road here and there. And I've got nerve damage permanently in my right hand and my thumb and my pinky from the handcuffs being on too tight. But if you take nothing else away from anything that I say today, the one thing I want you to remember is don't live and die. But better yet, live until you die. Make each day the best day possible. Ask yourself an honest question. And as humans, we have the tendency to lie to ourselves. So ask the question when no one else is around. But be honest with yourself. Are you doing anything today to change the lives of the people around you? Are you doing anything today to make the lives of the people around you better? Are you doing anything today to serve others? And if the answer is no to any of those questions, change what you're doing. It's not about you. Stop being so selfish. Look at the people around you. Look at the people that truly care about you. What are you doing today to be a better friend, a better son or daughter, a better sibling to the people around you? And I challenge you to take a deep look inside, because you guys are fortunate. You didn't have to get kidnapped. You didn't have to have someone hit you in the head to learn the one thing that I had to learn going through that process. But I beg of you to take the time on a daily basis to make someone's day better by you being nice to them, by you caring about them, by you extending a loving thought, hand, hug to them. Brothers and sisters, I want you to know one thing. That I have a testimony that God lives. I want you to know that one day we will have the opportunity to return back to His presence. That the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. Joseph Smith was a prophet that translated the Book of Mormon into our language. And if there's anyone in this room that's on the fence about going and serving a mission, I don't care how old you are, I don't care where you're at in your studies, go. It will be the best thing that you can do at this stage of your life. Will a mission make you perfect? No. Is it going to keep you active for the rest of your life? Evidently not, because there's a lot of people that go serve and then come home and go inactive. But what it will do is it will give you the foundation. It will give you the foundation to be a better person, a better father, a better husband, a better wife, a better mom. And we all need to be those things. I know without a shadow of a doubt that we have a modern day prophet. We need a modern day prophet to help us. The things that I need to know as a father of five is much different than what my parents needed to know raising three. Different time, different challenges. I can't thank you guys enough for the time that you've given me today. And again, I encourage you to take the time not to live until you die. Not to live and die, but live until you die. And make each day the very best that you possibly can. And I humbly say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
You're listening to Sunday Fireside. You've just heard a talk by Brother Travis Tuttle. He was a missionary serving in Samara, Russia, when he and his companion were kidnapped. There was a movie done about that kidnapping called The Saratov Approach. This talk delivered at the Ephraim LDS Institute of Religion back in March of 2015. As we continue with Sunday Fireside, next a talk by Elder Jack N. Gerard of the 70, a conference address from October of 2018 entitled, Now is the Time. Elder Gerard.
Several years ago, while preparing for a business trip, I began to experience chest pain. Out of concern, my wife decided to accompany me. On the first leg of our flight, the pain intensified to the point that it was difficult for me to breathe. When we landed, we left the airport and went to the local hospital, where after multiple tests, the attending physician declared us safe to continue our travel. We returned to the airport and boarded a flight to our final destination. As we were descending, the pilot came on the intercom and asked me to identify myself. The flight attendant approached, said they had just received an emergency call, and told me there was an ambulance waiting at the airport to take me to the hospital. We boarded the ambulance and were rushed to the local emergency room. There, we were met by two anxious doctors who explained that I had been misdiagnosed and actually had a serious pulmonary embolism or blood clot in my lung, which required immediate medical attention. The doctors informed us that many patients do not survive this condition. Knowing we were far from home and not sure if we were prepared for such life-altering events, the doctors said that if there was anything in our lives that we needed to consider, now was the time. I remember well how almost instantaneously in that anxious moment, my entire perspective changed. What seemed so important just moments earlier was now of little interest. My mind raced away from the comfort and cares of this life to an eternal perspective. Thoughts of family, children, my wife, and ultimately an assessment of my own life. How were we doing as a family and individually? Were we living our lives consistent with the covenants we had made and the Lord's expectations? Or had we perhaps unintentionally allowed the cares of the world to distract us from those things which matter most? I would invite you to consider an important lesson learned from this experience, to step back from the world and to assess your life. Or, in the words of the doctor, if there is anything in your life you need to consider, now is the time. We live in a world of information overload dominated by ever-increasing distractions that make it more and more difficult to sort through the commotion of this life and focus on things of eternal worth. Our daily lives are bombarded with attention-grabbing headlines served up by rapidly changing technologies. Unless we take the time to reflect, we may not realize the impact of this fast-paced environment on our daily lives and the choices we make. We may find our lives consumed with bursts of information, packaged in memes, videos, and glaring headlines. Although interesting and entertaining, most of these have little to do with our eternal progress, and yet they shape the way we view our mortal experience. These worldly distractions could be likened to those in Lehi's dream. As we progress down the covenant path with our hand firmly affixed on the iron rod, we hear and see those mocking and pointing their fingers from the great and spacious building. We may not consciously intend to do so, but sometimes we pause and shift our gaze to see what all the commotion is. Some of us may even let go of the iron rod and move closer for a better view. Others may fall away entirely because of those that were scoffing at them. The Savior cautioned us to take heed lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with cares of this life. Modern revelation reminds us that many are called, but few are chosen. They are not chosen because their hearts are set upon the things of this world and aspire to the honors of men. Assessing our lives gives us an opportunity to step back from the world, reflect on where we stand on the covenant path, and if necessary, make adjustments to ensure a firm grip and a forward gaze. Recently, in a worldwide youth devotional, President Russell M. Nelson invited the youth to step back from the world, disengaging from social media by holding a 7-day fast. And just last evening also invited the sisters as part of the women's conference. He then asked the youth to notice any differences in how they feel, what they think, or even how they think. He then invited them to do a thorough life assessment with the Lord to ensure that your feet are firmly planted on the covenant path. He encouraged them that if there were things in their lives that needed changing, today is the perfect time to change. In assessing things in our lives that need to change, we might ask ourselves a practical question. How do we rise above the distractions of this world and stay fixed on the vision of eternity before us? In a 2007 conference address entitled Good, Better, Best, President Dallin H. Oaks taught how to prioritize choices among our many conflicting worldly demands. He counseled, quote, "We have to forego some good things in order to choose others that are better or best, because they develop faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and strengthen our families," end quote. May I suggest that the best things in this life are centered on Jesus Christ and understanding the eternal truths of who He is and who we are in our relationship with Him. As we seek to know the Savior, we should not overlook the fundamental truth of who we are and why we are here. Amulek reminds us that this life is the time to prepare to meet God, the time which is given us to prepare for eternity. As the well-known axiom reminds us, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Understanding our divine origins is essential to our eternal progress and can free us from the distractions of this life. The Savior taught, "If ye continue in my word, then ye are my disciples indeed, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." President Joseph F. Smith proclaimed, quote, "The greatest achievement mankind can make in this world is to familiarize themselves with divine truth so thoroughly, so perfectly, that the example or conduct of no creature living in the world can ever turn them away from the knowledge that they have obtained," end quote. In the world today, the debate over truth has reached a fevered pitch, with all sides claiming truth as if it were a relative concept open to individual interpretation. The young boy Joseph Smith found that so great were the confusion and strife in his life that it was impossible to come to any certain conclusion who was right and who was wrong. It was in the midst of this war of words and tumults of opinions that he sought divine guidance by seeking truth. In April conference, President Nelson taught, quote, "If we are to have any hope of sifting through the myriad of voices and the philosophies of men that attack truth, we must learn to receive revelation," end quote. We must learn to rely on the Spirit of truth, which the world cannot receive because it seeth him not, neither knoweth him. As this world moves swiftly to alternative realities, we must remember the words of Jacob, that the Spirit speaketh the truth and lieth not. Wherefore, it speaketh of things as they really are and of things as they really will be. Wherefore, these things are manifested unto us plainly for the salvation of our souls. As we step back from the world and assess our lives, now is the time to consider what changes we need to make. We can take great hope in knowing that our exemplar, Jesus Christ, has once again led the way. Prior to his death and resurrection, as he was laboring to help those around him understand his divine role, he reminded them that in me ye might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Of him I bear witness. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
You've just heard a talk by Elder Jack N. Girard of the 70, a conference address from October 2018, entitled Now is the Time. You've been listening to Sunday Fireside. We invite you to join us again next week for another program in this series.